Welcome to the Reaction Podcast, hosted by me, Ian Martin. I'm delighted my guest today is Professor Helen Thompson. We're going to be talking about her book, Disorder, Hard Times in the 21st Century. The hardback came out last year. Many of you may have read it. There's now a new paperback edition, which is just out with some updated chapters and some new thoughts. Helen, welcome.
Pleasure to be here, Ian.
So in the time since we last spoke about this book, I interviewed you around the time of launch, a lot has happened. In fact, the war in Ukraine broke out on the day in which the book was published, I think. It's still rolling on. There's a lot to talk about, more fragmentation geopolitically, what's happening with Putin, with Xi, rise of the BRICS, all of that, Saudi, and then, of course, the situation in the Middle East. But let's just begin with Ukraine. You must feel vindicated in some sense that energy, oil and gas, its price, its power as a geopolitical instrument has been a really important feature of the war.
Yeah, and I feel a bit awkward like saying that, but it is true that I think I would have had a rather harder time persuading many people that energy is as central to geopolitics as I think it is if the events of last year hadn't happened, because it was a demonstration both how long-standing conflicts involving Russia as a, well, really as the world's energy superpower, can have profound geopolitical implications, but also because it brought, if you like, energy into people's homes. I mean, energy is there in people's homes all the time, but it made them think about it, because particularly in the first months of the war, so from February to, let's say, June, where oil was concerned and a bit longer, where gas was concerned, the price went up very considerably. And you see, like, Western governments, including Liz Truss's before she fell, promising huge sums of money to households in order to protect them through an energy crisis. So I don't think that anybody last year could have thought it was odd to write a book which had as much as about energy in it as mine did. The sort of counter to that is I don't believe that Putin went to war against Ukraine last year because of the undoubted energy fault lines in the relationship between Russia and post-1991 Ukraine. I think that's an important part of the story of that relationship, but I don't believe it was the motive for the war. So in that sense, because I wasn't predicting that a war was going to be the outcome of the strains in Ukrainian-Russian relations that I was describing, I also think that I can't say I was entirely right about these matters.
So Putin's interested in energy, obviously.
Oh, very much so. I think he's quite obsessed with energy.
But because it gives him geopolitical leverage?
I think, yes, but I think actually, in his case, he actually understands it in energy terms in a way that is probably unusual for leaders. I mean, either by himself or with someone's help, probably with somebody's help. You know, he wrote a PhD, or at least a university work, piece of work on the subject of energy. I think he has quite a good understanding of its historical importance, but he very much understands both, I'd say, its geopolitical leverage, as you say, but also the fact that for this Russia in the post-Soviet world, that Russia had a huge problem because of the pipelines, because the Soviet state had built the pipelines to sell gas and oil primarily to Europe, obviously, at that time, in fact, almost exclusively to Europe. And they went through states like Ukraine that post-1991 Russia didn't control. And so he spent a lot of time trying to construct alternative pipelines, particularly ones ultimately that went under seas rather than across land. So under the Baltic Sea, the Nord Stream pipelines, but also under the Black Sea, what became the Turk Stream pipeline. So I think that he thought about energy not just as something that gave Russia power, but also as something that caused Russia geopolitical problems.
What have you made of the way in which the Western powers, particularly Western Europe, has handled the aftermath of the invasion, particularly in energy terms, in terms of the work that was done on gas and storage, and quite a rapid response?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's several things to say here. I mean, I think in the case of the British government, you'd have to say we were pretty unprepared.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, given that for some weeks, if not months, before the 24th of February last year, British intelligence with American intelligence were the ones who were saying Putin's serious. It's quite hard to find any evidence that the British government then came up with an energy contingency plan.
It's a really good point because it
deal with the situation.
Yeah, the then Defence Secretary Ben Wallace had been touring European capitals openly and in public, saying this is going to happen. Mm. There is a war coming. He was believed in places like I think he was believed in Warsaw and in certain capitals, but in other places it was regarded as alarmism. But even though the UK government knew, it didn't start in October, November, December.
No, there's no evidence
before
that it did.
No, none at all.
No.
Which is a very odd thing geopolitically, isn't it? For Boris Johnson, who was particularly interested in the war and did warn early, as Ben Wallace did, to not join the dots and think there might be an implication for his famed net zero strategy. Why, do you think?
I don't think Boris Johnson was ever a prime minister who was going to involve himself very much with the specificities of energy. I mean, other people might be more surprising as to why they weren't joining the dots. But I think that there's a critique of, and this goes beyond Britain, I think it's in a way less true in the United States, but of European governments who haven't known, I think, for some time. I don't think it's always been true, but sometime, at least since the 90s until recently, how to think geopolitically about energy. And to the extent that they have, it's been like under the surface, which has its uses, but it doesn't really help when you get a crisis like the one that happened last year in explaining to citizens what the consequences of these energy problems are. In terms of Europe more generally, I think that in a way we can say that European governments, and obviously Germany is the most consequential here because it had the deepest energy relationship with Russia, coped better than we might have expected. But I think there really are some big caveats here. I mean, first of all, that when it came to gas, that the EU didn't put any sanctions on Russia. The supply ended because Russia effectively terminated it, except through the pipelines, ironically, that were going through Ukraine. Then there was the good fortune that China's demand for gas and actually for oil as well was quite significantly lower, certainly where gas was concerned, in 2022 than it was in 2021. So when you have more European countries wanting to import liquid natural gas, there wasn't as much competition for that supply from China as could reasonably have been expected looking at the previous year. And then there's the fact, and I've said this a lot of times, now that really European countries were able to get all the supply that they needed by pricing certain other poorer countries, particularly Pakistan, out of the market. In that sense, it was a zero-sum competition and for the supply, and European countries won because they're richer. And so at the same time as high energy prices were a problem for governments domestically, they were also an asset for governments, particularly where gas was concerned, in being able to procure supply.
But that was, I know some of the deals were longer term deals, weren't they, running forward several decades, guaranteed supply. But it was still all pretty rudimentary and patched together. Were you surprised? I was, because I must admit that I thought in the months immediately after the war, this is bound to provoke a realisation. It's a wake-up call, if ever there was one, about how energy works and how geopolitics is going to work in the next two or three decades. And it didn't really come. You see a little bit in what Rishi Sunak's doing now on net zero, a bit of sort of fiddling around the edges. They would argue it's more than that on annual licensing on oil and gas, and perhaps it's performative, but they are trying to make the point that oil and gas are still in the mix for maybe for longer than people think. But there hasn't been a Europe-wide moment of reckoning, has there?
No, but I think that's in part because the question of the net zero politics of this and the question of the geopolitics of gas and oil have got overlapping aspects to them. but they're not entirely the same. I mean, I think that there's really big questions to be asked on the oil side about supply, let's say, 10 years down the road, if electrification of transportation hasn't gone much further than it looks like it will have done within 10 years at the moment. But the criticism, in a way, I would make of European governments, and to some extent the United States, though it finds ways around it more easily than European governments because of domestic supply, is that they haven't really been willing to think about energy systematically across the board, to see the ways in which the multiple different energy sources that are now being used and are each important in different ways, though to differing degrees, interact with each other in the problems that they bring. So I'll give you an example actually from the US, is I think with Biden wanted to say, look, I don't need an oil policy because I've got a climate policy. We've got an energy transition policy. But actually they knew that they needed an oil policy. It was just called resurrecting the Iran nuclear deal. And then when that wasn't possible, then the fact that they needed an oil policy came to the surface, and he has to go off and, you know, Saudi Arabia and see Mohammed bin Salman. So to the extent that they do, I think, join the questions up, of the energy questions up, then that isn't the way that they want to present it, because our politics, I think, has become far too binary in terms of, like, are we in favour of what tend to get called renewables? I think that's an oversimplification of what they are, versus fossil fuel energy. And actually, the future is, for some time to come, is going to be considerably both.
Yeah. Just explain that point on renewables, because it's something we've talked about before, but it's just not really yet widely understood. There have been some other books since your book came out, for example, Ed Conway's book, Material World.
Very good book.
Examination of what's needed for the transition, or an explanation of really sort of how the world works in terms of commodities, rare earths and so on. What do you mean that renewables are not quite as renewable as people think?
Well, I think that the important thing to see here is how dependent solar and wind generated electricity are, because that's what we're talking about when we're talking about renewables on metals and minerals, including rare earth minerals. Now, I certainly think it's true that it's not exactly the same when you're dependent upon metals and minerals as when you're dependent upon extracting oil, gas and coal. That when you use energy, you use it once and that's that. With metals, over time, there will be capacity for using them again,
recycling them.
Not 100% probably, but there will be creative ways of dealing with that. But for the time being, there's an enormous amount of extraction of metals and minerals that has got to take place, and it's not all going to be renewable. And renewable is not quite the word, I think, anyway, for using for effectively what's more like recycling than renewable.
So in Boris Johnson terms, they sort of hello trees, hello sky. They come. What could be more renewable and sustainable than something that comes from the sun and from the wind? And but as you say, and as you've written, it involves a lot of intensive mining. It's a heavily industrial process, and it takes us into parts of the world which are contested and very difficult.
Absolutely, and it has a really clear geopolitics to it already. I mean, one around China, because China dominates the production of rare earth minerals and the processing of metals. That's not so much the production of metals, but the processing of metals, the metal supply chains that are necessary for low carbon energy. And even the United States, you know, is acutely dependent upon China as things stand. For rare earth minerals in particular. It's why, going back to, I think it was either 2019 or 2020, I think maybe, that Donald Trump declared, when he was still president, declared a metals emergency for the United States. But at the same time, if you look at the parts of the world where the metals are presently being extracted, crucially lithium, for example, they're in parts of the world in the global south. I mean, generally, I mean, this isn't 100% true because of the Russia question, but generally there's a preponderance of the metals that are necessary for low carbon energy in the southern hemisphere. So that's useful when it's Australia, but it's not so useful when it's Peru, let's say, or Chile.
Is there a point at which Do you think, I mean, it would help if people read your book? We're discussing Helen's book, Disorder, Hard Times in the 21st Century. Paperback edition is out now. It would obviously help if they read your book. But if a war in Europe didn't provoke that kind of rethinking from our politicians, what could? Is it the fundamental basic reality that European industry is paying far more than American industry for energy, one of the key inputs into the industrial process? That's not widely understood at all, but that continues year on year. It's a huge competitiveness challenge in Europe, and I include the UK in that description. Could, if you ended up with a recession or some kind of economic crunch, would it then be in the interest of politicians to say, look, let's be honest about this 2050 position, which, as you say, we are heading for more renewable energy, whatever that means, greener energy, cleaner energy, but it may take quite a few more decades more than people imagine. Why couldn't a politician explain that calmly to people and say that there are some trade-offs here and there's a balance to be struck? You do have to try and develop new technologies, but they're also fraught with difficulty, and we have to balance that with using existing fossil fuels and some nuclear. You need a mix.
I think that it would be better if the trade-offs were explained, and I think that the way in which net zero was pursued in this country in 2019 in the dying days of the Theresa May government was kind of exactly the wrong way to go about doing it. It basically presumed a consensus was there, that was there on the surface in Parliament. But as soon as you got into any level of specificity about what this energy transition was going to mean, even the basic question of how much work is net supposed to do in this, there wasn't really any answers to that. So it's not really then surprising that the politics of it become much, much more difficult when those underlying choices that have to be made like clearly rise to the political surface. I think if you take the European country that is most hit by the industrial energy crisis, if we call it that, which is obviously Germany, where we can see the economic data has been pretty poor now for at least for 4 months, I think you can see that the German government is very worried, both in terms of its willingness to pass measures or engage in measures that will provide support to firms. I believe there's some changes now being proposed to taxes on electricity as a consequence of this. And they're obviously very politically worried about it in terms of the Alternative for Deutschland party and the ability of that party to use both the cost of energy, and including in that secondary energy of electricity, but also the end of the Russia relationship as a means of like criticising the government, as also the issue of boilers and replacing boilers with heat pumps. But I think one of the reasons why that it's now harder perhaps than it was, let's say in the 70s, for politicians to talk about this is because they've also got to tell a fairly upbeat, optimistic story to companies who they need to drive the energy transition. That needs to be quite optimistic and upbeat and can do in order to encourage that. And that I don't think was quite there in the same way when politicians in the 70s
Capital was less globally mobile. Yeah. You weren't sort of putting yourself in the shop window in the same sense. That develops more in the 1980s.
But also I'd say as well is that although there was obviously interest in moving towards alternative energies and fossil fuels, obviously in particular actually nuclear, but it wasn't just nuclear. Where nuclear was concerned, the state was going to bear quite a lot of the capital cost of that. They're trying to do, or most governments anyway, particularly Europe, are trying to do the transition to solar and wind-generated electricity and then electrification much more via the private sector. And so the incentives have to be there. Either they've got to provide very strong material incentives, i.e. state backing for a lot of the investment, or the state actually directing quite a lot of the investment. All they've got to create an environment that's conducive to investment. And I think that high levels of investment, and I think the optimistic story about net zero has been part of the let's create that investment environment. Mm. It's just that it runs into a political difficulty, because citizens actually need to understand that these energy questions are actually not going away anytime soon.
But maybe it doesn't produce some kind of cataclysmic, dramatic shock. Maybe it's just year on year, yeah, it erodes European competitiveness and productivity. And just over the course of 10, 20 years, what's happened really since the financial crisis, that process continues, that Europe is just getting relatively poorer. And then by the time people have started to work out what happened, everyone involved in the UK is in the House of Lords anyway. And anyway, not a very optimistic thought. But just moving on to the Middle East, to another aspect of the crisis. When, I mean, 50 years ago, we saw the first of those great oil shocks, which, of course, was then followed by what happened with the Iranian Revolution in 1979. And then, I mean, do you think something similar could happen this time around? It hasn't happened in the immediate aftermath of October the 7th, those horrific attacks on Israel. But is there the potential? Would it require regional escalation or even something bigger than that to create another oil shock?
I think that there's a really interesting thing that's happened in this respect that is shown the ways in which the world has actually changed since 1973. Because if you go back to 73, the states that drove the embargo against the United States and Netherlands, Portugal, I think South Africa and Rhodesia as well, were the Arab states. And Saudi Arabia absolutely had to be on board for that to happen. So it wasn't just the Arab states where there were radical nationalists like Saddam Hussein, who was the oil minister of Iraq at the time. You know, it was the Gulf, if you like, conservative monarchies that were willing to do this. The state that of the major oil producers at the time in the Middle East that wasn't willing to do it, that was willing to put the price up, was Iran. And Iran was also the most important exporter of oil to Israel. Indeed, none of the Arab states had been willing to sell Israel oil ever since Israel's creation in 1948. And indeed, if you go back to the previous Arab-Israeli war, so 1967, Nasser, the then Egyptian president, was extraordinarily angry with the Iranians about their unwillingness to engage in a boycott of selling oil to Israel. He regarded that as the most direct means that the Middle Eastern states had of destroying Israel, and that Iran wasn't willing to be part of it. So if you look now, obviously, it's the other way around. You know, the Arab states are not interested in an embargo. None of them can embargo Israel, because Israel's buying oil primarily from Azerbaijan and then the United States and Brazil. But they're not interested, the Arab states, in embargoing any of the European states that are supporting Israel or the United States. It's Iran that's been calling for an embargo. The thing is, though, that Iran is already under sanctions. I mean, it's not that it doesn't sell oil. It sells oil quite a bit to the Chinese, and there's illicit oil goes elsewhere as well. But Iran doesn't really have the same capacity to deliver a blow to the oil side of the world economy in which the Arab states, I think, had in 1973. Meanwhile, then there's gas, which is much more important as an energy source than it was in 1973. It was not just beginning, but it was taking off, if you like, as an energy source. And now we're in a position where Israel is a significant gas producer and exporter, including to Arab states, to Jordan and to Egypt, both of which are quite dependent upon Israel, even though Egypt is also a producer of gas from the same offshore Mediterranean fields as, or in the same part of the Mediterranean as Israel. And even a state like Lebanon, where obviously Hezbollah involved, Iranian linked, Lebanon's been willing to agree a maritime border with Israel, which is unheard, really, if you think about what the implications of like that
in terms
are,
of recognition,
yeah. They don't actually recognise, but they do de facto recognise now by having a maritime border, and they're willing. The reason they're willing to do that is like cooperation of these offshore gas fields in the Mediterranean. So the energy picture around Israel in this is quite different than it was then. I'd say that if Israel itself has a vulnerability, it's probably through Turkey, because the pipelines that bring the oil from
Azerbaijan
come there. Now, I don't want to say that that means that there's no possibility of oil, this present crisis in the Middle East leading to an oil crisis, because I think that there is, particularly if you were to see attacks by either Iran or by the Houthi rebels backed by Iran in Yemen on shipping in the Persian Gulf of the kind that was there in the summer of 2019. And I think we can see, you know, that there are bits of moves going on that are quite provocative. Like, I think that there was an attack, I think either yesterday or maybe even today, from a Syrian drone on Eilat, which is the really crucial port for Israel in terms of access to the Red Sea. So I think if it escalates into a more general or more regional conflict, then we could see quite a lot of turbulence in oil markets. On the other hand, the basic structure of what's going on around oil and gas are not like they were in 1973.
What should we make of the role of the Saudis in all of this? Of course, there was that attempted rapprochement between Israel and the Saudis, which seemed to be getting somewhere, which may have been a factor, clearly was a factor, in terms of Hamas launching the attack when they did. How does that play out?
Well, I think the interesting thing about the Saudis is, if you look what they were doing this year and perhaps even last year as well, they were going all ways, really. So on the one hand, that they were willing to have very serious discussions with Israel around the Abraham Accords and involving the United States in that. And I think you could fit that in very well into a story which says that prior to October the 7th, that Israel's relations with a number of Arab states were probably more promising than they'd ever been. And I'm including in that the maritime border with Lebanon. But on the other hand, if you go back to March, then Saudi Arabia was agreeing a sort of diplomatic rapprochement with Iran.
True.
Under Chinese
auspices. Brokered by the Chinese.
Yeah, seemingly at least brokered by the Chinese. I suspect the Russians probably did have something to do with it too. So Saudi Arabia looks like it was keeping its options open. But I think that it's notable that Saudi Arabia hasn't been hypercritical of Israel compared to what might have been expected even 10 years ago. I think that, from what I can see from reading anyway, that they haven't entirely given up on the idea of some normalisation with Israel in the medium term.
You mentioned Russia there a moment ago. To what extent should we think of China, Russia, North Korea, Iran as operating like as a block? It's unclear to what extent they're coordinating their activities, but increasingly, are they operating as a loose alliance? I mean, several of them are not natural allies, Russia and China, for example. But is there some form of cooperation emerging?
I think there is some form of cooperation emerging, and I think it's been there actually for like quite some time. I think you can see the basis of the China-Russia axis, particularly actually where energy is concerned, all the way back at the beginning of the 20th century. I mean, if you go back to 2005, a year which I spent some time in disorder sort of saying, I think it's quite crucial for a lot of things happening that are now pertinent, the Chinese and the Russians were doing some joint military exercises together. If you just look at a map and then you see Iran's position in terms of like China's relationships with Eurasia, you can see why that's so important, even before we get on to Iran's place in the Persian Gulf and particularly the Strait of Hormuz. I think, though, you could say that Russia, at least, has had a complicated relationship with Iran. Maybe that they have got closer since Russia's invasion of Ukraine in terms of the supply of weapons from Iran to Russia. I remember, actually, I had a bit of a longer couple of paragraphs on this in the new chapter of Disorder, but then that section all became a little bit too complicated. There were too many moving parts. But if you go back to 2015, then Putin, I think, played a quite significant part in bringing Iran to the nuclear table. I mean, as I recall, when Obama was announcing the deal, he made something of thanking Putin for his efforts in that. So I think that from Russia's point of view, then Iran can be useful about some things, but that doesn't mean that that Putin wants Iran having a free hand. And at the same time, I don't think it can be in China's interest at all for there to be a regional conflict in the Middle East in which Iran takes the initiative and that the Persian Gulf becomes very difficult for the passage of tankers, many of which are heading to China. So China, I think, has an interest in stability in the Middle East too. And in that is the context, I think, in which we can understand why China was interested in Saudi-Iran rapprochement.
But then, of course, when the attack happened on the 7th of October, in the aftermath, the days afterwards, of course, everyone, and maybe this is Western confirmation bias or Western bias, everyone looks to the US, the US to make the diplomatic trips to the region, to be the international policeman in some way. They certainly don't look yet to China. But beyond that, what's your assessment of how the West, for want of a better term, the democracies, free world, of how it's organised and how coherent it is? I mean, it has serious political problems, taking the US just as a first step, but also Europe's difficulties.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is in many ways a much harder war for US and European countries and
the Middle East
and their relations with each other than Ukraine. I mean, I think Ukraine is, for the point of view of European countries generally and the European Union, is a bit of a nightmare, an underestimated nightmare, because whatever the outcome of it is, it's the states that are going to border Ukraine and the European Union, having made Ukraine or giving Ukraine candidate status for joining the European Union, that is going to have to bear the brunt of the responsibility for what happens next for Ukraine. And we can see that there were divisions within the European Union, more than appeared, I think, on the surface sometimes about what to do and how far to back Ukraine and on what terms. But when it comes to the Middle East, I think that one of the real problems for really everybody in Western countries is that they have a domestic politics that is much more bound up with the Israeli-Palestinian question than it's ever going to be bound up with the Russia-Ukrainian question. That doesn't mean that there wasn't anything going on where that was concerned, but a lot of the domestic politics around that was either about using it in terms of, like, let's rally NATO together on the one hand, or let's worry about energy and why are we allowing this energy crisis to happen to ourselves by being so tough with Russia where sanctions are concerned, even though that oversimplifies. But it wasn't really about the conflict between Russians and Ukrainians, where really clearly it is when it comes to Palestinians and Israelis. And that is obviously both a function of there being Muslim and Jewish communities, both in many European countries and obviously in the United States, but also because there are lots of political emotions that fly around on both sides. And that makes, I think, particularly for Biden, really, really hard in that if it's the case that a significant part of the Democratic base is hypercritical of Israel, as might now seem to be the case, then that makes it really hard for Biden in terms of how far he can go in backing fairly unequivocally what Israel does. And I think you can see that in a number of European countries too, before we get on to the fact that within the European Union that there are some governments that are clearly already quite uncomfortable with the strength of the support that's been given to Israel.
So the US dominates the global monetary order still. It's got this immense military power as well, and it's economy, as we described earlier, has much cheaper energy. Its productivity is rattling along. Some concern about a recession, but it may be more likely to be a soft landing. But if America does go and choose Trump, how should Europe be preparing for this? This is a question I'm obsessed by at the moment. I've written several pieces on it, on the need for a plan B of some kind. How should European capsules be thinking about a response, about a plan B in not just energy terms, but defence and security in case it does happen?
I mean, I think that the most urgent question will be about Ukraine, unless that the war has come to an end by the time that the presidential election takes place. Now, there is a way of thinking about what a Trump 2 presidency might be, which would be to say, well, he was actually pretty constrained in foreign policy last time. There was lots of what many people regarded as inflammatory rhetoric. But if you look at the big moves that he made, the first being more confrontational with China, well, that actually is the domestic political the centre of the domestic political consensus in the United States. If you then think of it as ending the Iran nuclear deal, well, the Biden administration hasn't been able to put the nuclear deal back together. If you think about it as his attempts at getting out of Syria effectively, completely, twice, didn't actually quite work. The question would be, I think, would a second Trump presidency be constrained by the same kind of forces that constrained him last time? And I don't think I think everything that happened would mean that he would, in a way, try to be more of a wild card in a sense. Nonetheless, I don't think that any single person in the presidency of the United States can override all the power of the foreign policy establishment in Washington. Now, that doesn't mean that the European governments don't need contingency plans. I think with Ukraine that they certainly do, and I would say there that's in significant part because I think the centre of gravity of opinion in the Republican Party generally has shifted as well. Yeah. That where Trump looked more like an outlier at the beginning, he doesn't look so much so now. But where it comes to, like, NATO, we're back to questions about whether there can be a European security architecture. And that would now has to include the question of what the security relationship between the European Union and the United Kingdom is, because in the formal sense, it doesn't exist.
Yeah, yeah. I'd view it as follows, that a Trump presidency, Trump 2, would be very different from Trump 1, in that during 2016 to 2020, whether it was because he didn't know what he was doing or craved in some way the approval of the general's military establishment, he appointed some really sensible people who stayed as long as they could stand it, people like Jim Mattis or H.R. McMaster, and a lot of the foreign policy and military work that was done was actually rather impressive. I still hear in other parts of Europe, people will say to me, look, Trump was anti-European security. Well, of course, his rhetoric was, whether he knew it or not, his administration substantially increased the amount spent on European deterrence. Forward deployments via NATO increased. You know, if you go to somewhere like Estonia, you can see the evidence for that. But in the second term, my concern would be that you get that those people would not be prepared to serve, and that he probably wouldn't appoint them anyway. That he's been radicalized post January the 6th, and I think we'd get some very strange appointments. People who wanted to, from the beginning, take on that terrible phrase, the deep state, and defeat it. So even if he didn't formally withdraw from NATO, if it just created confusion, chaos about deployments, arguments with the Pentagon, all of that, I would contend that Europe needs to have some kind of plan B developing. And it can't really be, because there isn't a single body that can handle it. It's not going to be the European Union. That's not its specialism, although the European Union is going to be really significant, isn't it, on weapons manufacturer and weapons manufacturer. But can it be NATO? Well, NATO rests on American power. Can it be bilateral arrangements like the arrangements between the UK and the French, and maybe JEF, the Joint Expeditionary Force, which the British instigated and many European countries are members of? Or is it a combination of all of that? I don't know the answer. I just think in Europe we should be talking about it.
Well, I think we should be talking about it anyway, because I think that in the world in which the United States is primarily now interested in the China question and has got a level of problem in the Middle East that it wasn't at all expecting. Is only 6 weeks since Blinken was saying that the Middle East been quieter than it has been for years, and the Ukraine war from Ukraine's point of view is not going as well as many hoped even 6 months ago, then I think regardless of who is in the White House, some really strategic thinking needs to go on in Europe about European security. Because in one sense, if it's not Trump this time round, it will be something down the road, because the structural pressures on the NATO relationship are pushing in the same direction, particularly in any scenario in which things become even more tense than they already are around Taiwan.
Yeah.
On Trump himself, I mean, I think I entirely agree with you. He's been radicalized by the end of his presidency in the events of the 6th of January of 2021. But I think a lot of that is also in American domestic politics. And he's still got to face the problem. He's still going to have to point people to these positions. Mm-hmm. And where the cabinet is concerned, he's still got to appoint them to nominate them and get them through Congress. And he's also going to be constrained, I would suspect, by Congress in the way in which he was last time. I mean, in terms of literally passing laws that stop him being able to remove the sanctions that were put on Russia. As I recall, they were sort of passed in the time between the election and him taking office that made him very difficult to undo.
I think there's legislation that essentially, or provision that prevents him from unilaterally withdrawing from NATO, that it needs the endorsement of Congress, I think.
Yeah, so there are certain things he could do unilaterally, remove or end, I should say, the Iran nuclear deal. But that's because Obama never had the confidence to put it to Congress in the first place, so it wasn't actually legislated for. But I still think that there would be significant constraints on what Trump could do. But in a way, that's not quite the point. I mean, it is the point in terms of the wildness of a second Trump presidency, but it's not the point in terms of, I think, that Europeans, we all in Europe, need to get geopolitically much more serious than we have been. And that's true both about security in general, and it's true about what we're going to do in helping Ukraine if and when the war comes to an end on probably not particularly good terms for Ukraine.
An American friend, policymaker, put it to me recently as follows, which is that he said you should think of the American relationship ebbing and flowing a bit. As you said, if it's not Trump this time, then it could be someone like Trump or with similar inclinations the time after next. He described it as a radio signal which comes and goes. He thought that we should be more optimistic about Europe's prospects of dealing, maybe this is just his view from the US, but we should be more optimistic about Europe's prospects of coping with it. As he described it, if we break those down into constituent individual problems, I think, can an answer be generated? So, for example, on Ukraine, if the very worst happened, and I think Ukraine has just asked for $45 billion from the US, could Europe, could it carry that burden? Now, it's an awful lot of money. It would create intense political difficulties. But it's not completely unimaginable that a sum like $35 or $40 billion could be put together by the European Union, Poland, France, Sweden, Finland, smaller countries like the Balts and the UK. A coalition of the willing potentially could be assembled.
I think in terms of the financial question that you're right. I mean, I don't think that is insurmountable at all. I think the much harder question is EU accession. And then that immediately has to raise the question of NATO accession for Ukraine. And if you just take the EU one, we've already got Orban saying essentially that Hungary will veto it. And obviously each member state does have a de facto veto on new members joining. So in that sense, either there has to be another government in Hungary by the time that this happens, or that Hungary would have to be bought off. And I suspect it wouldn't be the only state where there would be questions either. And part of the issue is that for Ukraine to be in the European Union would be quite transformative for the European Union. So that in itself would be a reckoning of what the European Union is and what the European Union is for. And it would have to be much more geopolitically serious as a union just by very virtue of having Ukraine in it. Because this would be a state that recently had to defend itself in a war against aggression from Russia. And that isn't true of any of the member states at the moment. I mean, they've obviously got long histories with Russia, but they didn't join just after this kind of war.
Yeah. Evidence that there's so much to talk about that we barely touched on China, maybe next time. But just a quick final question on China. What are the prospects, do you think, to be blunt, how close are we to war?
I mean, I'm always very hesitant about answering this question because I feel like I just don't know enough about the China Taiwan issue to make a well-informed judgment. All I would say is that I don't think there's anything inevitable about it, and that I think that at the same time, the Taiwan question from China's point of view probably can't be fudged for decades and decades longer. Not least because if the status quo is in some sense okay, so long as the Taiwanese don't push for independence, status quos don't tend to last very long, as we know in these. So even if there's like a few years of a relative calm around the actual status quo, events can upset that very quickly. And then if you think about it as, well, what happens if peaceful unification takes place? Let's say something comes out, the flow of events from the Taiwan's next election, then is the United States okay with that? Mm-hmm. Because it has such profound strategic consequences for the American position in the Pacific if China were to control Taiwan. So I think it's very hard to see how it's anything but dangerous. But at the same time, I just don't think that I anyway can see like very clearly like what the probabilities are of escalation over a 5 to 10 year period.
And it would be economically very disruptive for China.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, for that, it would be for everyone.
On that note, I just want to thank Professor Helen Thompson from the Department of Politics and International Studies at Cambridge for joining us on the latest edition of the Reaction podcast. We've been discussing disorder, hard times in the 21st century. If you haven't read it, I really encourage you to read it. The paperback is out now. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction and you want my weekly newsletter, go to the website, become a subscriber. Until next time, thanks for listening.